My fellow plebs, River is setting a new standard in Bitcoin. At river.com, you'll pay zero fees when you dollar cost average. Truly the best way to build your Bitcoin wealth. All Bitcoin at River is held in secure cold storage with 100% full reserves. There's no need to wonder what's happening behind the scenes. Your Bitcoin is your Bitcoin to withdraw at any time. Additionally, River lets you make Bitcoin payments via the Lightning Network, offers a Lightning integration for developers, and allows you to mine Bitcoin directly to your River account. River has a level of service that is unheard of in this industry, including phone support, private client advisors, and the ability to designate beneficiaries to inherit your Bitcoin wealth. River has become the premium name in Bitcoin that anyone can easily access. Sure, you have a place to buy Bitcoin, but have you tried River? See and feel the difference at river.com and the River iOS app, the preferred partner of Bitcoin Magazine. My fellow plebs, today's podcast is also brought to you by Moon Mortgage. As the world moves increasingly towards the mainstream adoption of Bitcoin and other digital assets, Moon Mortgage makes it possible to materialize your assets into real estate. Through the collateralization of mortgages with Bitcoin and other digital assets, Moon Mortgage will be launching lending solutions to allow investors to easily leverage their assets to purchase investments in owner-occupied property. Moon Mortgage's crypto mortgage will be launching soon for home buyers in Texas, Florida, and Colorado, and will also be open to investors in most states across the U.S. for investment properties. Welcome to the future of mortgages. Visit moonmortgage.com today to register and learn more. Moon Mortgage Residential is registered with the NMLS under number 235334. Today's episode is brought to you by Gordon Law Group. If you've tried to do Bitcoin taxes yourself, you know how complicated it is. You can spend hours and hours going through your transactions and researching tax forms, and you're still not sure if it's right or if the IRS will come after you. Or maybe you're so intimidated by Bitcoin taxes that you don't even know where to start. Gordon Law Group can help. Ditch the spreadsheets and feel confident with a bulletproof Bitcoin tax return. They can help with IRS payment plans, and they also provide a full range of legal and accounting services for Bitcoin and digital asset startups. Get your taxes done right the first time with the original Bitcoin and digital asset tax pros. Go to GordonLawLTD.com/BTC. As a bonus, they'll send you the ultimate Bitcoin tax guide for free. That's GordonLawLTD.com/BTC.
Hey, Spencer, how's it going?
Hey, going great, Chris. Thanks. Alex, good to be up here on stage with you. Looking forward to digging into your new book. Pretty exciting.
Yeah. Can't wait. Thank you.
Spencer, I guess if you want to kick us off with how far away we are from Bitcoin 2023.
Yeah, we're just 10 days away. Really exciting. I mean, in particular, is something I was going to mention, but Alex will be giving a keynote on the second day of the conference, May 19th. And that's going to be on Bitcoin versus the IMF. So I think that should be a really good one. Really looking forward to that for sure. But yeah, it's, you know, time is going by super quick. It felt like just yesterday we were a month away. So yeah, it's getting closer and closer by the day, but really looking forward to seeing everyone down in Miami. Should be a great time. And, you know, I think a lot of the noise of the previous bull market has kind of died down. The tours are gone and it's going to be super high signal. So I'm super stoked. So the focus of today's spaces is just going to be to review a little bit of Alex's book and give people a taste for what to expect when they get it. And this book is titled Hidden Repression, How the IMF and World Bank Sell Exploitation as Development. And for those who don't know, Alex has done a lot of great work through the HRF and as well as some stuff he's published on BitcoinMagazine.com talking about the dynamic between the IMF and the World Bank and developing countries, really laying out an in-depth picture of how these, I guess, quote unquote, development tools used by these banks to, you know, bail out these developing countries that have been ensnared in these loan programs to begin with, kind of the social, environmental, and economic consequences of these programs. And for me, it was super eye-opening. I mean, I had a sense of kind of the leverage that, I guess, developed countries have over these developing nations and how that relates to trade, but really seeing up close and personal, like what the consequences of those actions are is quite startling. So yeah, I guess, Alex, I guess I would open the floor up to you a little bit here. I guess, how does this book, Hidden Repression, like what was the impetus behind it? And, you know, how has this kind of differed from any of the work you've done in the past?
Yeah, well, thank you guys, by the way, for hosting me. Really excited about the conference. I will be speaking on Friday afternoon. I'll be giving a keynote on the IMF and the World Bank, and essentially I'll be delivering the thesis of the book in a short format that I think will be pretty interesting. So I hope folks will be able to join. I think it's going to be around 4 p.m. on the 19th in Miami. So looking forward to seeing you there. The book came about as a culmination of my curiosity into the international monetary system, which was in large part something I looked into as a result of meeting all these Bitcoiners from around the world and them explaining to me why they were Bitcoining. And they were Bitcoining because their local currency system sucked, or they didn't have the same financial opportunities that we might have in the United States. And I started to just look critically at the dollar system, how it was born, what it sort of does. And I started to look at some of the Bretton Woods kind of, let's say, pillars that were created when this system was birthed, let's say, after World War II, or rather, you know, in 44, and then kind of implemented in the wake of World War II. And two of the most important pillars of the Bretton Woods system are the IMF and the World Bank. So I was like, there's not like a whole lot of great content actually written about these institutions. Like, you can't just, for example, there's not like a, I don't know, you know, there's a lot of great books written about different aspects of the financial system. You know, there's things like, for example, you know, there's books about like the blow up of long-term capital management. There's books about U.S. sanctions. There's books about the Great Depression. There's really fun, approachable books about these topics. When Genius Failed, or Lords of Finance, even the Lords of Easy Money about the Fed. I mean, they're really good, approachable, fun books. But there's really nothing like that about the IMF or World Bank. There's pop culture stuff. There's like Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and there's Naomi Klein. And, you know, there's pop culture stuff that does speak some truth, but often makes exaggerations. And, you know, one of the interesting things is most of the critics of the bank and the fund end up being kind of like more on the socialist side, you know, and I didn't really agree with their solutions. So I wanted to have a different look at things. Now, of course, we find some of the same problems that socialists accurately point out about the bank and the fund. And in fact, there's even some libertarian books that have been written that point out the same problems. So when I start realizing, okay, there's like a really wide consensus of people who agree that these institutions are bad, maybe we're onto something here. So I just dug in and tried to, in my book, really explain what the IMF and World Bank are, like what they do, what they said they were supposed to do, what have they actually done over the last seven decades, and what's kind of been the result of that. And I think that when you look at it this way, it's very hard to escape an understanding of them as institutions that exploit, basically. They're basically neo-colonial institutions that help harvest resources from poor countries for rich countries, and they help deflate wages in poor countries, and they help harvest resources at lower than market rates. I mean, that's really what they do. It's sort of the TLDR, and that helps us in the West kind of have a higher quality of life. Like, it helps subsidize our quality of life. It doesn't mean that we don't have financial crises here, of course, but it would be like our economies would just be like not nearly as robust were we not able to drain resources from the periphery of the world as easily as we do. And if you have to think about it, like, the periphery of the world is where the majority of the world's people live, and it's where most of the labor is, of course, and it's where most of the natural resources are. You know, and what we call the third world or global south or whatever you want to call it, it is, again, where most people live and where most of the resources are. So a large part of our success as big advanced economic powers isn't just property rights and, you know, liberal democracy and, you know, personal freedoms. I mean, that's obviously a huge part of it. But there's also another part of it where we've designed these machines that basically exploit and extract labor, rent, and resources from the periphery of the world. I mean, this is just kind of how things have gone. I mean, that's what colonialism was designed to do. And then colonialism collapsed. You had a lot of financial crises in the West. You had the Great Depression, which was related. You had the oil crisis in the 70s, inflation in the 70s. A lot of this was related to like the imperial system breaking down, the colonial system breaking down. So in a lot of ways, the IMF and World Bank grew to kind of fill the vacuum that the colonial drain once served for Western societies. And that's kind of what they've done. I would also just note, and you know, you can go ahead with another question, but just to tie it to what's happening right now in Bitcoin, I just would want to comment. I mean, this is why it's so important for us to figure out ways to get as many people into Bitcoin as possible, as quickly as possible. I mean, what victims of the World Bank and IMF in the 1980s didn't have was like a way out. They had no way to really escape. Like, they were stuck with their local fiat currency, which would often get deflated, devalued. Their local economies would get crushed. Like, they had no way to like access a 24/7 open financial network. Like, that didn't exist. Okay, so fast forward to today, they do have access to that. And now all of a sudden you're seeing what's going to start happening as we get deeper into the Bitcoin adoption cycle, is that it's going to get expensive to use Bitcoin, like the main chain. So, you know, we're not as far along as we had hoped, I think, in terms of creating kind of second layer scaling or other kind of interesting solutions to different trade-offs to help people escape from the IMF and the World Bank. I think this is very important. It is hard to onboard people if it's going to cost $20 to process a transaction or open a Lightning channel. Like, that's just going to be more difficult. Now, it was fine 2 months ago, right? Or whatever, 3 months ago, when it was like a dollar, it was reasonable. But like, I don't think we can expect those like super low on-chain fees forever. And this is a nice little reminder. I think we're in like a little bit of a fee wave right now, and this will probably chill out, but we don't have that much more time to have cheap on-chain fees. So we really need to build out solutions. And there's all kinds, you know, there's Lightning, and some of the Lightning wallets today use trade-offs that don't work during a high fee environment. Like anyone listening who uses the Moon wallet is understanding what I'm saying. Like, they use a submarine swap. It's not working very well right now. Some other wallets are working well. Phoenix wallet seems to be working well. That's one that a lot of people use in our, let's say, in our space. So some of the stuff works, some of it doesn't. But I mean, that's why things like Fedimints are really interesting. There's a lot of things happening now that you really need to be pushed. Like, it would be nice to have these solutions like working now, because there's going to be these high fee environments. And this is so important for people who are trying to get out of these broken financial systems. Like, they aren't necessarily going to have the capital to use on-chain Bitcoin on a daily basis. I don't think that's a reasonable expectation. So we need to figure out ways to scale this thing to people where they have to make as few trust trade-offs as possible. So I think you're going to see, and I think that this fee market thing, regardless of whether it's temporary or not, it's going to force adoption of stuff like Lightning. Like, it's kind of amazing that you're seeing Binance come out and say in writing that they're going to add Lightning. Like, they weren't going to do that until they had to. That's the thing. But now maybe they have to, and maybe it makes sense for them, as if, you know, from a business interest point of view. But guess what? That makes it a hell of a lot easier for people in the global south if all the major exchanges and on-ramps and off-ramps are Lightning powered. Like, that's like obviously very useful. So we'll see what happens. But I just wanted to add that, guys, as like a way to kick things off. But tell me where you want to go from here.
Yeah, no, really well said. And I think kind of like the call to arms for solutions to these problems is super important. And we're kind of, I mean, I guess I'll speak for myself, was surprised to see kind of this explosion in fees and the impacts that's had on transacting on chain. And you've highlighted some of the limitations that will impose on different models for engaging with Lightning. But I kind of want to take it back a little bit. You mentioned that, you know, there's a lot of, there's some literature on the topic related to the IMF, yeah, the World Bank. You said it comes from, you know, libertarians, some socialists, but I think it's interesting, like, to think about, you know, who are you writing for this, yeah, book? Like, who is the audience? And like, I'm just thinking, you know, you also mentioned that you kind of described the IMF and World Bank as machines. And
yes.
It almost seems like that kind of takes the human aspect out of it. And, you know, it makes me think of Bitcoin too. It's like, is this just a matter of technology and technology adoption? Or is there, you know, people we need to be speaking to, interfacing with, to try and fix these systems, or is that, you know, I guess a little naive to even think about fixing them from within?
I guess to put it in context with the rest of my work, I think what I've been trying to explore, I guess it's not really like sculpting, it's more like digging. It's more like archaeology, or maybe even digging out a dinosaur skeleton. It's like you uncover like a tooth, and then you're like, okay, so there must be like a head over here somewhere, but we don't really know what this thing looks like. So I'm digging, doing like reporting. I'm talking to Bitcoiners in all these countries, like over the last 3-4 years. I'm asking them about why they used Bitcoin, and I'm starting to like unearth this thing, but I don't really know what it is. And it's really interesting because what ends up happening is, as they tell me why they're using Bitcoin, I start to unearth some more truths about the international monetary system and how it works. And so Bitcoin was like the key for me. It was the start of the rabbit hole, right? It gave me the entrance. And then I go down and I start realizing, oh my God, like, what is this thing? And it is kind of like a machine. Again, at its most basic, the IMF and World Bank, and they maybe weren't necessarily created for this purpose, but this is the outcome of what they do. It like zooming out over decades, they extract resources and cheap labor from poor countries, and they subsidize the way of life of people in rich countries. That's a very simple way of looking at it, which of course, like, nobody working at these institutions would ever admit. They would say that's crazy. But when you look at the data and you look at the impact, and you just even think about like, and I'll give you an example of like an IMF program in a particular country, this is exactly what they do. So if you look at, and I have a lot of data in my book that people can look at, and you know, we can debate the data, we can debate whether it was intentional or not, or just sort of an outcome of the system, maybe path dependent. We can all debate that. That's fine. I don't necessarily think there was like one meeting where a bunch of people from Europe and the United States got together and said, oh, here's how we're going to like screw over like poor countries. Like, that's not how it went, most likely. Like, well, maybe it did, but seems unlikely. This wasn't like some sort of Jekyll Island thing, I don't think. I think it was more like, this is an outcome of our way of life, and what we're doing is what's happened. But basically, what an outcome of this system is that since 1982, the flow of funds has gone from poor countries to rich countries, that which is counterintuitive. You would think that like wealthy countries would be like benefacting or investing in or sending money towards poor countries and trying to help them. That would be, I guess, a naive way of looking at it, or hoping to look at it. But in reality, what's happening is wealthy countries are like sucking a lot of resources away from poor countries to the tune of trillions of dollars per year. Okay, so that's really interesting. So since 1982, the flow of funds has gone from south to north. Okay, interesting. And then you start looking at like, well, what is this? And it's like, you start looking at what it is, and it's like billions of pounds of stuff. It's like precious metals, it's steel making ingredients, it's energy, it's oil, and then it's labor. It's like the blood and sweat and tears of people, like it's their time. And that's what's been extracted, and it's a really large chunk of like what we consume here in the West. So if you want to get a sense for like what our life might look like if this drain didn't really exist, this like IMF World Bank powered drain, it's something like 50% of all the materials we consume in the West, and something like a third of all of the labor that we rely on for our lives is from the global South. So meaning we get it for like a lower than market rate. It's like labor that's done somewhere else for way cheaper than we could do it. And it's like stuff that we got for way cheaper than maybe what they should have sold it for. And if you think about that, well, what would our life look like if we had like way less stuff and much higher labor prices? Well, we'd have fucking crazy inflation is what would happen, right? So this is really what you get at, is that the bank and the fund exist to like lubricate this flow. That's the outcome of what they do, so that we have like a more comfortable quality of life here. And the way they do that is, it's clever, it's through debt. It's not through a warship or a cannon or like outright slavery like it used to be. It's actually just through debt, and they just issue a lot of debt. They issue an increasing amount of debt. So they basically entrap all of these countries into what are called debt traps that are inescapable. So like, for example, the average large global South country like Bangladesh maybe, or Mexico, you know, in Bangladesh's case, you know, WTF happened in 1971 is an interesting thing to think about. But like in the early 70s, beginning of the fiat standard, this country had like $100 million of external debt. Okay. Maybe not great, maybe not, but it's not terrible. Okay, so today they have $100 billion of external debt, which is just inconceivable. I mean, they're never going to pay that back. But what ends up happening is like our system makes these loans, and then, you know, when these countries inevitably fail to pay back the loan, which of course is more like they have to pay back more than what that we than they borrowed. This is the basic of principal and interest, right? So if they borrow $10 million, they have to pay back 15 or something like that, right? So you have this growing debt pile, and rather than let them go bankrupt or to like write it off, like our system doesn't like that. Our system has no incentive for that. We would prefer to issue more debt. So for example, anytime one of these countries gets an IMF bailout, like Argentina, for example, recently, they'll get a huge amount of money, big enough to cover all the existing debt, plus plunge them into more debt. That's kind of the way it works. So it's just, if you look at the total external debt of what was called the third world since the 70s, it's a crazy exponential curve. It's really wild to look at. And the design is, the system is such that like these, you know, these countries will not ever be able to pay this off. So what they have to end up doing, and remember, all of this debt is dollar denominated debt. So they like are in this insatiable quest for dollars to pay back debt. So what they end up having to do is they marshal resources that normally could go towards like domestic productivity, industry, feeding their own populations. They actually like shrink that effort, in some cases dramatically. And instead, they focus on obtaining dollars. So how can we get dollars? Well, we can sell like to wealthy countries what they need, and they'll give us dollars. Remember, they can't print dollars, and they can't really like go out and just like, they can't just like swap their currency for dollars. Like, A, there oftentimes aren't like liquidity markets, like pairs for these countries to do that at scale. And B, if they start doing that, it causes like an immediate like collapse in the value of their own currency. So there's challenges to like getting dollars. The best way to get dollars for these countries is to earn them through exports. So what ends up happening is like all these countries that are in this debt trap run by the IMF, the World Bank, more recently, China has its own version, which we can get into. But the best thing they can do is export what we want. So it like sort of engineers their society to export what we want instead of maybe what's good for them. So what ends up happening is they make a lot of coffee, tea, rubber, palm oil, aquaculture, shrimp. They make stuff that we want, or, you know, stuff that rich countries need, instead of like healthy, productive food and things that are going to like empower themselves and make them more sovereign. And that's the story of the debt trap. And that's really the story of the World Bank and IMF like as a whole.
My fellow plebs, come celebrate Bitcoin Winter in Miami at Bitcoin 2023. The largest Bitcoin conference in the world returns to Miami from Miami 18th to the 20th. Head on over to b.tc/conference to get your tickets today. Use promo code BMLIVE to get 10% off your tickets before prices go up. Plebs, if you're like me and want to gain a deeper understanding of what's going on within the Bitcoin market and broader macro environment, then you need to subscribe to Bitcoin Magazine Pro today. There's a free and a paid version of this daily newsletter where our market analysts Dylan LeClaire, Dr. Jeff Ross, and Sam Rule break down what's going on in the market so you don't have to. Subscribe today at BitcoinMagazinePro.com.
Really well said. And I think like the point about, you know, that these debts are dollar denominated is so important. Like, how are they going to get dollars? And as you've articulated, that is going to be largely through exporting their natural resources. And, you know, reading some of your work on Bangladesh was just fascinating. I mean, you mentioned how much debt they have now, like $100 billion. And, you know, if they're to default on that debt, you know, that's really not an outcome that the system issuing that debt would like. The creditors,
right? Remember, you know, like that debt is like held by Western creditors mainly. Maybe it's, you know, a mix of Western and Chinese creditors. Let's say they don't want that to go to zero on their balance sheet. Like, they don't want to write that off. They would prefer just to issue more debt to keep the party going. Right.
Yeah, and like, so it kind of just makes me think, like, what is the ultimate like like, where does this system go? Where does it devolve to? Like, I'm just thinking about, like, in the context of Bangladesh, you have all of these negative social and environmental externalities. Like, you have kind of the social and cultural capital that could be collapsing in these places. Like, where you used to have farms that had a diversity of goods that they were creating, livestock, different crops. Now, you know, it's become heavily polluted. You have, like, one commodity, and that could be
monoculture. Monoculture, yep.
Yeah, and so, like, over time, like, I just think about, like, okay, how long can this go on for? Like, I guess you could continue producing more shrimp, but I feel like that leaves so much out of the equation, like political stability and just like social cohesion. Like, how does this resolve itself, if it does?
Yeah, I'll get to that, but just to pause on that, like, people forget, like, large-scale industrial monoculture crop stuff is so bad for the environment. I mean, if you ever see that movie Big Little Farm, I think that's what it's called. It's really great. It's about these people who go out, build a farm out of nothing in California somewhere. But, you know, their farm at the end of the day is very diverse and has all kinds of little ecosystems helping each other ecosystem out. You know, they have trees that are like, they have some sort of pest, but then the ducks come in and eat the pest. And like life is a circle. I mean, it sounds cheesy, but it's true. Like, you need like rich ecosystems, but like you take a place in Bangladesh that had one of the richest mangrove ecosystems in the world. We're talking tigers, dolphins, all kinds of stuff. And they start cutting down all the trees and building these like dams and plugging the dams filled with salt water. So like you're turning all this like arable land into salt water so that people can dump shrimp fry into it and raise shrimp and sell it. I mean, it's devastated the region. So I have like a chapter on this in my book, but that's something that the World Bank paid for. Like the World Bank went to the Bangladeshi leaders and said, here's hundreds of millions of dollars. Can you know, we think you should do shrimp farming. And what ends up happening is that, you know, it becomes one of the biggest exports of the whole country. I think it's the second biggest export of Bangladesh right now, shrimp. I mean, think about how crazy that is. So, and like such a massive percentage of the profit goes to a really tiny handful of people. Yeah, the people at the very bottom of the chain are like basically laborers. I mean, a lot of like modern day slavery is going on, child slavery. They often like are losing money doing what they're doing. Like they often borrow money to be able to like set up a shrimp farm, and then over like 10 years they like actually lose money doing it. This is what we mean by like wage deflation. We're actually talking like one outcome of the World Bank and IMF policies is like during large periods of structural adjustment, like the 80s were obviously very pronounced in this, but it's happening right now as well. There's like almost like an echo of what happened in the 80s. The amount of time that it takes you to get 1,000 calories of rice or beef, like put money aside, like the amount of time it takes you to get 1,000 calories of rice or beef or whatever, it increases. So it could even double, right? So that's what we call wage deflation. So yeah, that's happening. I mean, and you know, where does this go? This is only possible really because of the international monetary, the fiat monetary system. This is possible because like one country can essentially like mint the reserve currency. So I think this is why you have this credit bubble growing and growing and growing. Like probably one of the biggest bubbles of all time is this like sovereign debt bubble. And none of it is like democratic in the sense that like it's not like people consented. In most of these global south countries, the borrowing was done by dictators who obviously didn't care what the people thought, and the IMF preferred actually to work with these dictators rather than work with democracies where they would have to like deal with Supreme Courts, property rights of local people. Like they didn't want to deal with that protest. Screw that. They just wanted to deal with some military guy who could just get it done. This is very, very common. And that's what got me really down the rabbit hole along with Bitcoin in the first place. I'm like, well, wait a second. Like if these institutions exist to help people, why are they bailing out these dictators? It doesn't make any sense. But you know, what you have is this system that just keeps going and going. And I don't think it does unwind until like some external like new factors introduced. And I do think Bitcoin plays a role there, right? Like I think that you're going to see like an unwinding of some of this sovereign debt over the coming decades. Like some of it's going to actually go to zero. And I think that we're going to probably shift to a world where first there's probably going to be like various reserve type currency assets And then eventually I think Bitcoin becomes very, very dominant there. And in that world, you can't just print $30 billion to bail out some country. Like, we have to be a lot more careful and prudent with that. And I think that it's certainly possible you could have like an IMF type institution where like nations pool capital. Like, don't forget, at the beginning, when all these nations were joining the IMF and put their down payment down to join, it was in gold. So they gave a bunch of gold to the IMF, all these countries. It was actually kind of a giant rug pull. All these countries in the 60s, 70s, when they joined the IMF, they gave a certain amount of gold and then dollars. Like, usually they couldn't give it all in their own currency. So the IMF is actually like, the third or fourth largest like holder of gold in the world. They still have all this gold that they got like at a huge discount way back when. But anyway, so remember, like, at the beginning, the IMF did have some sort of commodity money type standard. And it was supposed to be this like pool of capital that, like, when a country had a crisis, it could like go to the, and could go borrow from this pool of capital, which makes sense. That's fine. So, I mean, I think that you might have something like that, maybe in a Bitcoin standard. I just think it's like way more like way less exaggerated in terms of its role and size. Same thing with the World Bank. You may have a bunch of nations pool together capital and say, hey, we want to have like a fund that helps projects in the developing world that maybe private capital doesn't have the appetite for. Okay, fine. Maybe that still exists, but it wouldn't be nearly as exaggerated as it is today in terms of its power and size. I hope that helps.
Yeah, definitely. And like, one of the points I kind of want to try to tease out here is like, what are the limits of this extractive system? Like, I'm thinking like, it's almost like, you know, rather than selling development, enabling development, they're enabling destabilization. Like, I think back to Syria, like in Syria, mm-hmm. the Syrian war was kind of precipitated by, as far as I'm aware, a lot of farmers in kind of the outskirts of the country faced a water shortage, and they ended up migrating to the city in order to be able to find work. Their farms were no longer profitable. And this created so much, I guess, social dissolution, like, I guess, you know, so much social change, people moving, migrating across the country, and created a bunch of conflict that, you know, precipitated out of that. And there were all of these, you know, feedback loops, created a lot of complexity as it relates to the conflict. But at the end of the day, it seems like there's all of these downstream effects from environmental degradation that are going to precipitate lots of conflict. So I kind of, where I'm going with this is like, mm-hmm. does this system ultimately like, do its own mechanisms like hollow it out from the inside? Like, how long can, for example, again, Bangladesh, like, how long can they go on like impoverishing people in this way? Like, it does it become a social problem?
Well, this is why Bitcoin is so important, is because I think it can go on a really long way. Like, you basically have power structures in place that exploit the many to enrich the few, and unfortunately, like, they can be quite robust. And what you say is correct, in as much as oftentimes the structural adjustment policies that the fund and at times the bank use kind of shape these countries and really damage their environment. And of course, I mean, they damage the people, but, and this is obvious, like, anyone who's from a global South country can tell you the IMF is not good. Like, can tell you that when they, like, Egypt right now is getting an IMF structural adjustment, like, the, and like, the cost of living is like skyrocketing for people. Like, the price of bread is like going way up. This is not like a good thing. It's not like some miracle. Oh, great, we got the IMF coming in. No, I mean, it basically, usually their policies lead to a recessionary type environment where the GDP of the country declines and the mortality rate goes up. So, I mean, people basically die as a result of these structural adjustment policies. Like, the number of people who died is uncountable, but probably in the tens of millions. I mean, but no one will ever go to prison or be held accountable, unfortunately. It's just sort of the way it is, which is why Bitcoin is important as an escape. Like, people can opt into something where their purchasing power can't just be like, you know, ransacked. I think that's really, really key. But because I don't think you stop the system any other way. I mean, it's like a drug dealer dealing drugs to an addict. There's no therapist here. Like, there's just the drug dealer and the addict. The addict is are these dictators or these unaccountable governments for the most part. And the IMF, World Bank, and the Western creditors are the dealers, and the people don't have a voice at the table. Like, that's the problem, is that, like, A, the big countries that do receive this credit for the most part have tiny, tiny voting percentages at the IMF. Like the IMF is largely controlled by the, you know, G5, essentially. The U.S. has like a veto by itself, but like with its allies, it can get more than half of all the votes. Meanwhile, these like huge, huge countries that receive the debt have tiny, tiny percentages of the votes. So like that's sort of built into the governance of the system. It's not based on population. It's based on like a power post-World War II power structure. And then beyond that, so first of all, these big, big countries like Brazil, Indonesia, Ethiopia, Pakistan, they don't have very much power there in the first place, even though they're like the target of the policy. But more than that, usually the leaders of these countries are pretty unaccountable. Like maybe a little better today, but like in the 70s and 80s, I mean, they were mostly all military dictators for the most part. And they were taking this money hand over fist with no regard for what it would do to the future of their country. Like they did not care, and they weren't going to personally pay back the money. They were going to spend it on weapons and on interest and on police. They did not invest this money wisely. That's another very important thing. Like this enormous amount of borrowing happened, and very, very little of it went to like build the productive capacity of these countries. So, I mean, it's a very grim assessment, but I think it's important to assess in this way and then figure out, well, where do we go from here? Well, you know, hopefully there's a world where this can't be possible.
Yeah, and I think like in kind of the same forward-looking vein, I think it's important to kind of unpack the opposite side of the IMF coin, and that might be China's Belt and Road Initiative, and that's something you mentioned earlier. But I'd be curious, like, if you could maybe highlight first of all what that is for the audience, and then second of all,
sure,
if there are any differences or kind of just, you know, the lay of the land as it relates to that.
Yeah, well, it's more like a World Bank copycat system. Basically, the Chinese Communist Party has a bunch of like institutions set up to lend to developing countries, many of them in geographic orbit to China, but also a lot in Africa and Latin America. And it's a little different from the IMF and the World Bank. I mean, again, it's mainly like for infrastructure projects, but the scale of lending is enormous. Like it's almost like toe-to-toe with what the IMF and World Bank are giving out. In some cases, it's even more. I have the data in my book, but it's pretty staggering, the size of this thing. Oftentimes they have worse conditions than the IMF and World Bank, like in terms of interest rates, repayment dates, things like that. They're pretty stiff. The thing is that the Chinese government doesn't print the reserve currency. So they've only really started doing this in the last decade. We don't know how much, and they're encountering a lot of problems right now. Like a lot of the countries they invested in, you know, don't want to pay them back, and they don't have the ability to just like print dollars so that they can just loan more money out. Like if they start just like printing RMB to do this, that causes big problems. And it's unlikely that they're going to like dishoard their savings to keep the structure in place. So I don't know. I think it's pretty reasonable to assume that this is going to start to like shrink a little bit from where it is relative to the West's role. But I mean, it's really big right now, and they invest in all kinds of stuff across the developing world, and they're encountering a lot of problems. Like again, a lot of the countries they loan to are unable to pay back, and they don't have the same printing press type thing that the West has in terms of being able to mint the reserve currency. So it's going to have a big challenge, which I think is good. I mean, I think it's for as bad as the IMF and World Bank have been, I think the CCP obviously is much worse. So I think this is going to be terrible. This has been terrible for countries. They don't even make lip service about human rights. So it's not great, but I do think that they can coexist. Unfortunately, like it's not like what the last decade has proven is that the IMF World Bank model is very like lucrative for the issuer of it, like whoever's controlling it, the creditors of the system. Like it gives them enormous control over the world, and I think that other large powers obviously want to copy that. They've seen how this thing works, and they'll start doing it in their own sectors and in their own regions. So I think the general idea is very compelling, and China obviously has copied it in some way. I don't know how far they're going to get with it. It's very large right now, but I think you'll see other powers do the same thing in their own regional areas. This is all like a fiat construct. Obviously, it's most potent when you can just issue the reserve currency. But I think in general, this kind of like resource extraction, harvesting operation is going to be tougher to do at scale and sustain if the reserve currency is more scarce, basically. I think this will be tougher to do. So I hope that helps.
Yeah, definitely. And Chris, feel free to jump in if you have any questions. But I guess I'm just curious, like, Alex, who do you see as being like the important audience for reading your book, Hidden Repression? Like, when you're putting this out there, you know, I assume you're hoping to engender some type of action or change your dialogue. And like, who are you hoping will engage with this? And like, just really, really quickly, like, I see a lot of kind of the language you use and kind of the issues you speak to is actually resonating quite well with more of a liberal audience.
Yeah.
And perhaps, you know, libertarians certainly would appreciate your commentary as well. But like, that's, you mentioned like Naomi Klein earlier, and I'm like, you know, a lot of what you're saying, I figure she would be relatively favorable towards. Like, so yeah, who do you see as like, you know, your target for this type of work?
Well, I think that, again, the discourse on the IMF and World Bank, the critical discourse has largely been from very leftist perspectives. And I think that alienates people who are not leftist. And it's unfortunate because I think a lot of the conclusions of these leftist thinkers on this particular topic are quite accurate. It's just, I don't think their solutions are very good. So I'm hoping to have like a wider scope in terms of that kind of person who would read the book. My you know, suggestions are not to like empower revolutionary socialist leaders or confiscate property or, you know, create some sort of world bank that's just not the US dollar. You know, it's sort of similar with the de-dollarization thing right now. Like, you have a lot of de-dollarization people who are correct in like, they're observing de-dollarization, which is not fake, it's real. I would agree. In the same way that they were observing that the IMF and World Bank were bad, but they're like, they're going the wrong way with it. Like, a lot of these leftist folks are like cheering de-dollarization so that like China can be more powerful, which is totally nuts. So it's similar to like, a lot of the folks over the decades, they cheered kind of against the IMF or World Bank, but then they would end up cheering for these like dictators, basically, which I just never really understood. So you're seeing a lot of that now. So I'm trying to provide more of a middle ground of like, hey, dictatorship's bad, exploitation of human rights is bad, but also like what the IMF and World Bank has done is bad. Like, how about both of it's bad, and let's try to like trace out some sort of solution that's not going to empower either side. So that's kind of my hope. I mean, generally speaking, the book is not, I mean, I learned from people in the developing countries that this book is, it's not going to teach them anything new, I don't think. This book is for Americans. I mean, it's for my people and Europeans. I mean, it's for creditor nation population people. It's for people who have benefited from the World Bank and IMF. It's for them to learn about what it is, what it's done, and then hopefully they have some sort of reflection on the system, and maybe they decide to make a change. I think the single most powerful change you can do is to work in Bitcoin and to expand Bitcoin communities, but they can choose whatever they want to do. But I don't think that anyone in the West like should be ignorant about these topics. Like, they should actually start to understand like what we've done to the world to secure our own riches. I think that's really key. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I think like to your point, like the awareness of this, I mean, people could certainly be more aware of this dynamic that's playing out. And I think like when you see it in black and white and in the way that you describe, it's truly shocking to think about the costs that are externalized onto people that don't have a seat at the fiat governance table.
Totally.
And yeah, I mean, I think you also just highlight so well like why so many people are passionate about Bitcoin and the human rights and kind of the like equitable governance that it can deliver for society, and like, well, you know, why it's so important.
Well, this is just a thread in my writing generally, but like it's similar to the petrodollar system. Like, a lot of people today discount the petrodollar, and they discount the IMF, and they're like, well, these are like whatever it's in the past. It's history. Well, it's not history for people who live in who are affected by the Saudi Arabian government today in terms of the petrodollar. And you know, it's not history for anyone who's you know 25, 30 years old or older in any sort of global South country, because when it came to the you know the IMF's implications in the 80s, you know, these two, the petrodollar and the IMF are similar in as much as they exist to prop up the dollar system. And if you looked at what happened in the 80s, like with the third world debt crisis, like these, our Western banks were so levered up on debt to Latin America, Africa, et cetera, especially Latin America, that if like essentially like we did the bailout to save ourselves, not to save them. Like if Mexico had just defaulted and like just didn't do anything, it would have probably caused like a 1930s style banking crisis in the West. Like that's why we had to come in and bail them out all these different times. Like we didn't go in and try. The Asian financial crisis was not about like saving Asian people. It was about saving like who had lent them money. So once you start to really understand this, you start to realize that the IMF and World Bank, you know, they exist to like repurpose resources to like keep the system going and keep it stable. And the petrodollar was similar. Like it existed to like bolster the dollar system. So, you know, my goal has been to show how these mechanisms, which did indeed absolutely bolster the dollar system in both cases as like kind of key pillars of the international monetary system, they had massive costs. And we just don't really talk about these costs. So that's what the book's dedicated to, are the costs.
Love it. Yeah, no, very well articulated. And I guess I want to be cognizant of your time here, Alex, but I just wanted to encourage everyone to check this book out. It's available on Amazon as well as in the Bitcoin Magazine store. If you just go to bitcoinmagazine.com, click on the books link, it'll take you right there. But yeah, I'm really looking forward to reading this. I mean, Alex has been going at this for a long time now, really highlighting these issues in great detail. So really excited to get my hands on this. And for anyone who's a fan,
thank
Alex
you.
Will also, yeah, of course. And yeah, for anyone who's a fan, Alex will also be doing a book signing at Bitcoin 2023, just 10 yes. days from now. So that'll be great. He'll be in the deep with the whales as well as yeah. in the Bitcoin Magazine Lounge. So
I know we currently only have a hardcover. I understand that. We're going to have eventually, probably this summer, we'll have a audio book and an ebook, which will be great. But I just wanted to note that like essentially that this book was written, we'll say like in the public, like there's a first draft of this book that exists as a free online essay called Structural Adjustment that I wrote last year for Bitcoin Magazine. So if anyone like can't for whatever reason get the book, they can at least get the main gist on the Bitcoin Magazine's website for free. The book is an expansion and edited version of that essay with new content. And, you know, basically put into a book package. But I just wanted to point that out there that like for folks who can't, whatever, for whatever reason, get the hardcover, they can get the gist of it online. And then like our friends said here, we'll have copies in Miami. I'll do signing. I'll also be doing a talk about it, which I'm excited about. So anyway, thanks so much to the folks at Bitcoin Magazine for helping me on this journey. If you like the book, please leave a review on Amazon. That definitely helps. Really, really appreciate it.
Yeah, of course. And I'll also just say really quickly, yeah, definitely leave a review. That definitely helps as far as the algorithm. That goes a long way. So that'd be greatly appreciated. Cool. But yeah, Alex, I really want to just thank you again for coming on today. That was fascinating. And yeah, we're all looking forward to seeing you speak at the conference as well. Is there anything else you want to leave our audience with before we get out of here? Anything we didn't cover that you thought might be good to highlight?
No, I think we're good. I hope the book helps shine a light. I know folks may not necessarily agree with it. I did get some interesting feedback from people who work at the IMF and World Bank. Some more positive, some less so. But I think it's very possible for you to work in an industry or field to be very good at your job and not understand maybe the global implications of what you do. I think that that's just sort of true in a lot of different industries. And that's probably what I think about the average IMF or World Bank employee. Like, I don't think they're like bad as a person. What happens though is like when you accumulate all of the outcomes of all of the loans that are made and all the policies that are undertaken by the borrowing countries, and you zoom out and look at it over time, this inescapable conclusion emerges of exploitation. There's just no way to argue it otherwise, that I've seen at least. And sure, there's a couple cases where you can say, well, this country really benefited or whatever. But in general, like, that is, those are exceptions. Like, in general, this system has existed again to just drain and exploit. And I think that it'd be good if we were just open about that. And I think that the future, the solution, the goal is just to improve our own societies and reform and not do this anymore. The goal or the solution is not to like cheer on the end, in my opinion, of the United States or democracy and cheer for dictators. That's a terrible, terrible idea. I think the solution or the goal, hopefully, is to like end this practice in the West, just like ending slavery or ending surveillance or ending the prison industry or ending the war on drugs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like, this is something we need to reform and we can improve. The answer is not like to go support some the CCP or whatever. Like, it's very distressing to see people kind of push this. Like, no, the answer is to like, is for us to get better and to reduce our exploitation of other people and to improve our societies. And I think Bitcoin is a useful ally in that quest. Like, I think it's going to help us get there. So anyway, thanks again. Hope the book inspires some thoughts. Folks want to reach out to me, they can DM me. Very happy to talk about the book on podcasts, etc. Looking forward to seeing a lot of you in Miami in a few days.
Awesome. Likewise, Alex. Yeah, thanks again for coming on. And yeah, just again, everyone, I encourage you to read the book. And it sounds like Alex has had some interesting conversations with the IMF and World Bank folks. Maybe the beginnings of a dialogue, hopefully, will emerge from that. So I'll stay tuned for that. But awesome. Thanks again, Alex.
Thanks, guys. Take care. Thanks, everyone.
My fellow plebs, come celebrate Bitcoin Winter in Miami at Bitcoin 2023. The largest Bitcoin conference in the world returns to Miami from Miami 18th to the 20th. Head on over to b.tc/conference to get your tickets today. Use promo code BMLIVE to get 10% off your tickets before prices go up. Plebs, if you're like me and want to gain a deeper understanding of what's going on within the Bitcoin market and broader macro environment, then you need to subscribe to Bitcoin Magazine Pro today. There's a free and a paid version of this daily newsletter where our market analysts Dylan LeClaire, Dr. Jeff Ross, and Sam Rule break down what's going on in the market so you don't have to. Subscribe today at BitcoinMagazinePro.com.